Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents R.A. Salvatore's The Saga of the First King, Book 2, The Ancient. Narrated by Dylan Lynch, with performances by Bradley Smith, Alyssa Wilmoth, Kimberly Gilbert, Yasmin Toison, Dan Sontag, James Lewis, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, Joe Brack, David Coyne, MJ Casey, Ren Casey, Mort Shelby, Patrick Bussink, Stephen Carpenter, Michael Glenn, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, James Keegan, Drew Copus, Thomas Keegan, Scott McCormick, Eric Messner, Thomas Penny, Christopher Sheeran, and Johan Detweiler. R.A. Salvatore's The Ancient.
Still holding the gemstone tight against his forehead, Branson leapt up to his feet, catching himself surely and with incredible agility. He was the highwayman who could challenge a laird's champion in battle and win. Branson pulled the gemstone away. Immediately he swayed. He caught himself, though, and kept Kay Dale at bay with an upraised hand. Then he stubbornly put his gemstone back in his pouch and let it go. He took a step, awkward and unsteady. He nearly fell over, but he did not. And he even managed to glance back at Kay Dale to see her and her concerned mother exchanging frowns. Hand shaking, arm flailing, Branson managed to get his fingers back around the precious gemstone and secure it to his forehead. How could he be so fortunate and miserable all at the same time? The soul stone freed him from his infirmities, made him whole, heroic even, and yet, at the same time, it trapped him and held him dependent to its powers.
I will find my physical strength. It is there. The soul stone shows it to me. I will overcome this infirmity.
Some years ago. He walked across the windblown ice of the glacier known as Cauldron, its frozen surface not causing him the slightest discomfort, not even in his feet, though he wore open-toed sandals. He was Baden, ancient Baden, leader of the Samhastes, who knew the magic of the world more intimately than any others in the world. Baden was the greatest of them. No creature alive was more connected to those magics than this man. So while he stood upon hundreds of feet of solid ice, he felt, too, the earth below that freeze, where the hot springs ran. Those very springs had led him to this place, and, as he neared the edge of the glacier, the wide expanse of Alpinador opening before him, the old Samhaste trembled with excitement. He knew. He knew before he glanced down from the edge of the glacier that he had found it. Mithranadun, the steamy lake of legend, the place where the god Samhain forsook his mortal coil and melted down into the earth, the source of all magic, the guardian of eternity. Samhain's servant was death, men like Baden believed, who would bring the souls to the harsh judgment of the god who suffered no fool. When Baden looked down, his breath fell away from him, and many heartbeats passed before he could catch it once more. Below him was a fog-shrouded, huge, warm lake, perhaps 20 miles long and half that wide.
Mithranadun.
The old man smiled at the rarely seen sight. He had found the holiest of Samhaste places and the source of his greatest magic, just as his war with the Abelicans and Vanguard to the south had begun to ignite.
Dame Guaidra.
He referred to the leader of the men of Vanguard.
You chose poorly in taking an Abelican as your lover.
Most who knew Baden, or knew of him, for few actually knew Baden in any real way, believed that 8 full decades and part of the 9th were behind him. Ancient Baden slowly turned about to survey the area.
Mithranadun.
He looked up to the heavens.
You there!
He lifted his hand toward a distant circling crow. The bird heard him and could not ignore the call. Immediately it turned and swooped, speeding down, upturning its wings at the last moment to light gently on Ancient Baden's outstretched hand.
I would see below the mists, to the scar Samhain rent in the earth.
Suddenly, Baden launched the crow with a flick of his hand, his eyes tightly shut, for he did not need them anymore. Ancient Baden saw through the eyes of the crow. The bird followed his instructions perfectly, sweeping down from the glacier, soaring vertically the hundreds of feet before it straightened out and rushed across the lake. Ancient Baden took it all in, the caves of the trolls lining the bank, the multitude of islands, dozens and dozens, some no more than a few rocks jutting above the steamy waters, others large and forested. One of those, particularly large and tree-covered, was dotted with huts of the general design common to the barbarians of the region, though not nearly as fortified against the elements as those found on the Alpinadoran tundra. Sure enough, he spotted the tribesmen. Large and strong, decorated with necklaces of claws and teeth, though, as they resided on a warm lake, they wore far less clothing than the average Alpinadorian barbarian. Baden fell within himself and experienced the warm air coming off the spring-fed lake, warming the wings of his host. So the barbarians had dared to inhabit this holy place. He nodded, wondering if he could somehow enlist them in his battles against Gwydra. Some tribes had joined him, if only for brief excursions against the southerners, but none of those occasions had gone as Baden would have hoped. These northerners, the Alpinadorians, were a stubborn lot, predictable only in their ferocity and wedded to traditions too fully for Baden to hold much sway over them. The old ancient reminded himself why it was important for him to keep his eyes turned southward, toward the northern Hants province of Vanguard and to Hants proper herself. These were his people, his flock, the civilized men and women who had followed the Samhaste ways for centuries. They had followed unquestioningly until the upstart Abel had brought them false promises in the days when Baden was but a child. The Samhaste let those unpleasant thoughts go and basked again in the beauty of Mithranadun. The crow continued its glide over an almost barren lump of rock. Almost barren, but not uninhabited, he saw, as the bird sped past. It pained the old man greatly to see Powries, red-capped dwarves, settled upon the lake. But even that could not prepare him for the next sight, and when the bird passed another of the islands, Baden noted a familiar-looking design well under construction. Even here they had come. Even in this most holy of Samhaste locations, the Abelican heretics had ventured and now seemed as if they meant to stay. So shocked was Baden that he lost connection to the bird.
This cannot stand.
All thoughts of enlisting the barbarians on the lake dissipated from him. They were all unclean. They all had to die.
This will not stand.
I knew my course. How could I not? I had escaped my infirmities partly through use of the Abelican gemstone known as the Hematite or Soul Stone. But even with that item of focus, most of my liberation had come as a result of the training I had received by reading the book penned by my father, the Book of Jest, the body of knowledge by the Jester II Mystics, an order to which my mother belonged in the southern land known as Bear. If there was more freedom to be found from my affliction, I would find it there. The road was obvious. All my hopes to free myself from the gemstone and the shadow of the stork resided in one place, to be sure. That place lay to the south and east, through the port city of Ethelbert Dos Entel, around the arm of the mountains and into the desert land of Bear. There I would find the Walker Clouds and the Jester II Mystics, There, I would strengthen my understanding of the ways of Jess to the point, it was my hope, where I would be free of the Stork. It wasn't just my hope, but my only hope. And therein lay my fear, deep and rooted and pervasive to the point of paralyzing. We left Pride Town, banished and glad to be. With war raging between the lairds, there would be no easy passage, of course, but the ease with which I turned away from the road to Entel to the more hospitable land surprised me, even as I justified it to Kaedale and her mother. Pretty words, grounded in logic and honest fears, made the change in course an easy sell to my companions, but no amount of apparent justification could hide the truth from me. I changed course, delayed my journey to Ethelbert Durs Intel and beyond because I was afraid. This is no new epiphany. I knew when I changed paths the true reason for my hesitance. It was not based in the many fierce soldiers Lair Ethelbert has spread across the land. Even as I offered that very reason, too dangerous to Kaedale and Callan, I recognized the lie. And now I accept it. But what is left to me if I travel all the way through the deserts of Baer to the land of the mystics, only to find there that there is no deeper understanding to be gained? What is left to me if I learn that I have progressed as far as I can ever hope to climb, that the shadow of the drooling, gibbering Stork will never be more than a stride behind me? My condition dominates every aspect of my life. Even with the Soul Stone strapped to my forehead, focusing my line of chi, I wage constant battles of concentration to keep the Stork at bay. I practice for hours every day, forcing deep-seated memories into my muscles so that when they are needed, they will hopefully heed my call. And yet I know that one slip, one break of concentration, and all of my work will be for naught. I will bumble, and I will fail. And not just in battle. My concerns run far deeper than simple vanity or even the price of my own life. I cannot make love to my wife without fear that she may birth a child of similar disability to my own. My one great hope is to be free of the Stork, to live a normal existence, to have children and raise them strong and healthy. And that one great hope lies in the Walk of Clouds and nowhere else. Is it enough to have the hope, even if it is never realized? Would that be a better existence than discovering ultimate futility, that there is no hope? Perhaps that is the secret, the hope, for me and for all men. I hear the dreams of so many of the folk, their claims that one day they will go and live quietly in a peaceful place, by a stream or a lake or at the edge of the mighty Mirianic. So many claim those dreams throughout their lives, yet never actually find time to execute their plans. Are they afraid, I wonder, as I am afraid? Is it better to have the hope of paradise than to pursue it truthfully and find that it is not what you expected? I laugh at the folly and preposterousness of it all. Despite all of my worries, I am happier than I have ever been. I walk beside Kaedale and her mother Callan, and I am warm and in love and loved. My road at present is west and north, not to Ethelbert Durs Intel, not to Baer, not to the Walk of Clouds. Branson Geribond.
Small and thin, Branson nevertheless walked with the stride of a confident man. He wore the simple clothing of a farmer, breeches and shirt and a wide-brimmed hat under which sprouted tufts of black hair. He carried a thick walking stick. Too thick, it seemed, for the fit of his fine hands. But it, like the hat, like the man himself, concealed a great secret, for within its burnished wood was a hollow, and within that hollow, a sword, a fabulous sword, the greatest sword in all the land north of the Belt and Buckle Mountains. Fashioned of wrapped silver-el steel, decorated with etchings of vines and flowers and with a handle of silver and ivory that resembled a hooded serpent, the sword would grow sharper with use as the thicker outer layers of wrapping were nicked or worn away. This sword had been fashioned by Branson's mother, Senwi, and whenever he held it, he could feel in its details and workmanship the spirit of that remarkable woman, long dead. A simple wagon pulled by two horses and a donkey tethered behind rolled beside him on the cobblestone road, driven by a woman who commanded Branson's attention so completely that he was caught off his guard when another woman walked up beside him and tucked his silk bandana up higher under his hat.
I like the way you look at her.
Callan motioned with her chin toward her daughter.
She is the most beautiful woman I have ever seen. Every time I look at her, she seems more beautiful still.
A man looked at me like that once, or so I thought.
Branson understood the latter all too well, for he knew Callan's sad tale because it was intricately and intimately entwined with his own. Callan had been in love once, but not with her husband. She met her soulmate after she had already been given in marriage, without choice and without say, as had been the custom 20 years before in Haunts. The revelations of her adulterous affair had brought her a death sentence. As per the brutal Samhain tradition, young Callan had been sacked, placed in a canvas bag with a poisonous snake. After being bitten repeatedly, her veins coursing with deadly poison, she had been staked out on the edge of Pride Holding and left to die. Branson's mother had come upon Callan on the path and intervened, had used her gestatu magic to draw the poison from Callan and into her own body. But unknown to Senui, she was with child, with Branson, and the poison damaged him severely. Thus, he kept close his second secret, concealed under a bandana that he wore under his hat. The bandana held in place a soul stone, a hematite, a magical gemstone enchanted with the Abelican powers of healing. While wearing that stone, Branson could walk normally with confidence. Without it, he reverted to a clumsy and awkward creature, often derided as the Stork.
Your lover betrayed you.
He had no choice. He would have been killed beside me if he had either denied or confirmed the affair.
That would have been a noble deed.
A stupid one.
Speaking the truth is not stupid.
Then throw away your hat and draw your sword out from that log you call a walking stick. I loved him, and he gave to me my Caedale.
Branson followed her gaze to his beloved wife.
Then I forgive him, his cowardice, whatever his name. For he gave me Caedale too, I suppose.
As your mother gave you to her. As your mother gave life itself to Caedale by saving mine when I carried Caedale in my womb.
Tell me true. Would you have stopped Senui if you had known that drawing the poison would so damage me?
Well, perhaps I would.
Callan glanced at Caedale, which made Branson smile all the wider.
Nor would I. I would rather be the Stork with Caedale beside me than a whole man without her.
You are a whole man.
With the gemstone.
Or without it. Branson Garabon is a better man than any I've e'er known.
And perhaps one day I might walk without the Soul Stone. Such are the promises of the secrets of the Jester, too.
What are you discussing with your titters and giggles? Are you stealing my husband, then?
Oh, but if I could!
The sound could only mean one thing on these roads in this day.
Stork.
Branson was far ahead of her warning already. He closed his eyes and severed his connection, one that had become almost automatic at this point, with his Soul Stone. Immediately, the young man's fluid motion ceased, and he began to walk again in a gangly and awkward manner. Callan and Caedale looked about.
Laird Delaval's men.
Make way! Move this wagon off the road and identify yourselves!
He's speaking to you.
Branson struggled to turn about, finally managing it, though he nearly tumbled at several points.
What are you about?
Both men crinkled their faces with disgust.
My son.
You admit that?
Barb, go on now and leave him be. Wounded in the war he was. Took a spear in the back saving another man. He's deserving your respect, not your taunts.
Where was he wounded?
In the back.
Good lady. I've not the time for your ignorance, nor for your feigned ignorance.
South of Pride Town.
It was then the younger man fixed his gaze upon Caedale, his grey eyes immediately lighting up with obvious interest.
He's not really my son. He's my daughter's husband, so I'm thinking of him as such.
Daughter's husband? He's married to you?
Aye, my beloved. We're for Delaval to see if any of the monks there might be helping him.
The soldiers shared a look. The younger one slid down from his saddle and moved beside Branson and Callan.
What's your name?
Branson.
Bran.
Branson.
Branson.
Yes.
Stupid name. I'm sorry for your loss.
He's not dead.
Sorry for that, too. Monks aren't to help this one. Better for him and for yourself if he just died out on the field. You're loyal to bringing him to the monks, I expect. But if he isn't for pleasing you, then you just let me know.
A coach was coming up the road behind them.
Or maybe she's liking those jerking movements in their lovemaking.
Just get the wagon off the road.
But the ground is uneven and full of roots, and our wheels are worn and will not...
Just shut your pretty mouth and be glad that we've not the time for other things. Or the time to take the horses and wagon in the name of Laird Delaval. Not that any of them are worth stealing.
Don't, I beg.
The man grabbed the nearest horse's bridle and roughly tugged the creature to the side, guiding the wagon down a small embankment where it rolled fast for a few seconds, coming to rest up tight against a tree.
Bow your heads for Prince Yezelnik, Laird of Pride!
As the coach rolled by, all gilded in shiny gold and pulled by a fine and strong team, Branson noted the drivers, a pair of men he had seen before. He saw, too, the Lady Olim, Prince Yezelnik's annoying and spoiled wife, as she stared out the window. He smiled as he glanced up at her from his half-bowed head. She regarded him with a start, which seemed a bit of recognition. Branson winked at her for that, and she fell back, putting her gloved hand to her mouth. That made Branson smile all the more, but he kept his face aimed at the ground to make sure the gray-bearded soldier didn't catch on.
He is a prince, you say? Or a laird, for you're calling him both.
Prince Yezelnik of Delaval.
Named Laird of Pride. Soon to be Laird of Delaval.
Aye, and the King of all Haunts, don't you doubt? Ethelbert, soon to break. And when we're done with that one, we'll put the other lairds in place in short order.
Aye, now that we've got the river running free of old wild northern men and goblins, and Palmarstown joined in Laird Delaval's cause, the ship's moving and it's not to be long. Ethelbert's city of Entel will find herself blockaded by the spring, and without his supplies and warriors flowing in from the Southland, he won't last long.
It amused Branson to think that Yezelnik was in line to become Laird of Delaval and even King of Haunts. The man was a fool and a coward, Branson knew all too well. He had come upon the very coach that had just rolled past a long time before when vicious bloody cap Powrys had forced it from the road. Yezelnik, his wife, and their two drivers, one of whom had been seriously wounded, were surely doomed. But Branson, the highwayman, had come to save the day. Of course, he had taken some reward for his efforts, much more than the stingy and ungrateful Prince Yezelnik had offered, and so the tale of his heroics had been buried by the prince's wounded pride. Branson closed his eyes and reconnected with the soul stone set under his black silk bandana, leaving the stork far behind.
King Yezelnik?
We should have gone straight out for bear as we planned.
No choice to us.
Kaedale didn't argue. Both of them had wanted to get out of Hunts to board a ship in the port of Ethelbert Dorsentale and sail around the Belt and Buckle Mountains to Bear. Branson's greatest desire, at least that which he expressed to his two companions, was to find the Mountains of Fire and the Walk of Clouds, the home of the Gestetu mystics. Their centuries of wisdom had created the tome that Branson's father had penned. Branson's mother, Senwi, had been of their order. In their midst, Branson believed he would find the answers to his dilemma. There he would attune himself more fully to his Kichi Kree, his line of life energy, and would thus free himself of having to wear the soul stone strapped to his forehead. That soul stone allowed Branson to keep his line of life energy straight and strong. Without it, his energy sputtered and flitted in every different direction, leaving him the crippled stork. The Gestetu had his answers, he believed, and he prayed. But he could not go there at that time, as he had hoped, not through Ethelbert Dorsentale, at least, for the place was locked down, and any man who entered the holding of Laird Ethelbert without proper authorization would find himself pressed into service or hanged by the neck. And so the trio had come southwest instead of southeast, and now near Delaval, the principal city of the land, the seat of power for Laird Delaval, the man who would be King of Haunts. Rumors along the road said that passage would be gained to Bear from that city, though it would be a roundabout journey indeed, sailing up the great river, the Maeser Delaval, recently named for the ruling family, then through the southern expanse of the Gulf of Hants, and down along the broken region of small holdings known as the Mantis Arm. It would be an expensive journey, no doubt, and perhaps one full of danger, but the roads simply were not an option at this time of intense warfare. Or perhaps they were, but Branson wasn't quite ready to make that all-important journey. They were moving again soon after. Around a bend in the road, less than a mile to the west, the trio came in sight of the renowned city nestled at the base of southern hills surrounding three fast-flowing tributaries that swept down through the streets and joined in a deep pool before the city's northern wharves. This was the head of the Maeser Delaval, a river whose currents swirled and backed with the varying tides of the northern gulf. The city was everything Branson, Kaydale, and Callan had imagined, with rows and rows of stone and wooden buildings, many two or even three stories high. A stone wall surrounded much of the town, including all of the central region. Within it sat the most impressive structure that any of the three had ever seen, a castle so imposing and expansive that it dominated the landscape wholly. A series of three connected keeps whose walls towered so high and strong that Laird Delaval's designs on ruling the entirety of Hants as the one king suddenly seemed all too tenable. By late afternoon, the trio had come to the outskirts, crossing through lanes bordered by trade shops of every type and with a large produce market set in a wide square just outside the city wall. A few peasants moved about the market, old women mostly, trying to get in a last purchase before the vendors closed their kiosks.
Rotten goods. Kitchen throwaways from the castle, no doubt.
No different than in Pride Town. The lads and their closest take all the best and we get what's left.
Except the best, that we never let go their way in the first place.
All the best that a certain black-clothed highwayman took from them.
You can't be thinking...
I often am.
...of letting him out here. The highwaymen, I mean. Don't you be thinking of stealing anything in this town. Laird Delaval frightens me.
Branson didn't reply, but of course he was thinking precisely that. They were turned away at the gate, for no wagons and horses were allowed inside other than those owned by the fortunate nobility who lived within the walls, and the higher-priced merchants and tradesmen who had to pay dearly for a license to bring a horse or donkey or wagon inside. The guards did point them at a nearby stable outside the wall, however, and assured them that the proprietor was a man of high regard. They went to the stable yards, where Yeniam, the stable master, looked over the horses.
They both need shoeing, to be sure.
Yeniam was a tall and very thin man with a dark complexion and darker beard that grew in every day.
You've been walking a long way.
Too long.
The man stared at Branson.
Bringing him to the monks. He was hurt in the war.
But it'll do you no good. Not unless you got good gold to pay. And lots of it.
Our funds run short. We were hoping that you would have need of the horses and the wagon.
Buy them?
They've walked too much of the roads.
True enough. And the donkey?
We'll be keeping that one. We've a long way to go yet.
Knowing their negotiations to be in good hands, Branson let Kaydale lead him off to the side. Sure enough, Callan joined them shortly after, jiggling a small bag of silver coins and even a single piece of gold.
And he's to board Dooley for us free for as long as we're in Delaval. A fair price.
More than.
Many of the peasants outside the wall began streaming for the gates, moving eagerly and chattering with obvious excitement. Callan and Kaydale flanked Branson and moved him along swiftly to beat the rush. Fortunately, they weren't far from the gate, and with a rather lewd wink at Kaydale, the young guard let them through.
What is it then?
The laird's come down. Laird Delaval. King Delaval soon enough, by the graces of Abel and the Ancient Ones. He's come down with this lady and all the others. Tonight, the brave Prince Yezelnik's to be formally named as Laird of Pride Holding. That and a host of other honours on the man. Oh, but he's handsome and so brave. He's killed 100 of Ethelbert's men, don't you know?
Kaydale smiled and nodded, hiding her knowing smirk well as she turned to regard Branson, who of course knew better than to believe any such supposed heroics attributed to the foppish Prince Yezelnik. But Kaydale's smile disappeared in a blink, for Callan stood there alone with no sign of Branson. Immediately, Kaedale brought a hand up to her pack, realizing as she grasped it that it had been relieved of some of its contents. It was not hard for her to guess which things might have been taken. She gave an awkward bow and moved away from the peasant woman, catching her mother by the elbow and leading her to a quieter spot.
What is he thinking?
That with all of them down here?
Oh!
Her husband was a stubborn one, she knew, and that stubbornness was likely to get him killed. Branson didn't change into his black silk suit until he reached the shadows at the base of the stone wall to the castle's highest and most fortified keep. As he had expected, almost all of the soldiers had gone down to watch the pomp and ceremony of the anointing of Laird Yezelnik. The main gates were guarded, he noted as he crossed about the side streets and back alleys, as were all the entry points to the castle proper. But Branson was Jester too, or a close approximation at least, and he didn't need a doorway. So he moved to the back wall, out of view, and donned his black suit. He glanced around and saw no guards in the area and held confidence that any who were supposed to be here, behind the structure and thus blocked from the merrymaking, were likely away from their posts watching the happenings in the lower bailey. He couldn't be sure, though, and that truth gave him pause.
But you are the highwayman.
Branson fell within himself. He thought of the gemstones, of the malachite, and used the feelings its touch had inspired to reach that corresponding energy within his Kichi Kree. If he had had the magical gemstone in his possession, he could have floated off the ground, he knew. But even without it, even just remembering its powers, Branson lightened his body greatly. He reached up with one hand and pulled himself up the wall. Like a spider, he scrambled, his hands and feet finding grooves in the stone. So weightless had he become that it mattered not how deep the ledge or how firm his grip. In less than a minute, the highwayman had scaled the 75 feet of the highest tower all the way to the one narrow window on this backside of the structure. He slipped into the dimly lit room. This was the Tower of Royalty. He knew it once from the many valuables. Paintings, tapestries, vases, and a plethora of other trinkets and utensils and artworks. The highwayman rubbed his hands together and went to work.
It is long overdue and less than you have earned.
Lady Olam entered her private bedchamber.
Your uncle should have named you Laird of Delaval and been done with it. His only son is not worthy, of course. Laird of Pride Town. Now I suppose we will have to live in that dreary place.
She pulled off her bulky bejeweled dress and an assortment of accessories. Stripped to her sheer nightdress, she sat down at her vanity, admiring her powdered face in the pretty mirror set atop the small marble table. One by one, she pulled off her oversized rings, each set with a fabulous precious stone. They paled in comparison to the necklace she wore, though, which was set with diamonds, rubies, and emeralds one after another, three rows thick and from shoulder to shoulder. Olam gently stroked the precious stones, staring at them in the mirror as if in a trance. So fully did they hold her attention that she didn't even notice the black-clothed figure that had moved up to stand directly behind her.
Allow me to help you with that, dear lady.
A hand clapped tightly over her mouth.
Do not cry out, I beg of you. I will not harm you, dear lady, on my word.
He gave her a plaintive and questioning look and eased his hand away from her mouth just a bit. Olam nodded her head, and the highwayman pulled his hand away.
You have come to ravish me. Take me then, but be quick and be gone and know that I shan't enjoy it.
Olam turned further about and threw back her head, the back of one hand across her forehead as if in despair. The movement thrust forth her breasts, of course, and the sheer nightdress did little to hide her obvious excitement.
Take me then! Ravish me! Have at me with your animal savagery.
And force you to make little barnyard noises?
Oh yes, if you must. If that is what I need do to escape murder at the end of your blade.
But all I want are the jewels.
But...
I beg your silence.
The highwayman put a finger over his pursed lips, fading into the shadow so seamlessly behind a tapestry that Olam had to blink and stare stupidly, wondering if he had ever really been there.
Ah, wife, I'm Randy from the excitement of the day.
He paused and looked at her admiringly at her nearly naked form and obvious state.
Apparently, I'm not alone in my humor. I am the Laird of Pride Holding.
My lord.
Olim looked past him as he turned again to the spot where the highwayman had gone. Had gone and returned, she noted. For he stood there leaning against her vanity, one arm bare and one blanketed in black silk crossed over his chest. A look of utter amusement on his face, his so handsome face.
Oh, my princess, I am the Laird of Pride Holding.
So you have mentioned a dozen times. If you say it a dozen more, perhaps you will convince yourself you are worthy of the title.
You?
I could be no one else.
How?
Your interrogation techniques leave much to be desired, I fear. More so when one considers that if anyone here is a prisoner, it is not I.
Not you?
Yes, you. Not I.
Not I?
Yes, you.
You?
Now you have it. You.
Do not harm him! Take me as you will. Ravish me.
Olim!
I will do anything for you, my lord. I will suffer his passion for you, my love. I will save you with my womanly charms.
With your jewels, you mean?
Faster than either of them could react, he came forward and snatched the necklace from Olin's neck. Then, for good measure, scooped the rings from the vanity.
Not again!
In a moment of uncustomary courage, Yezelnik threw Olim aside. He snapped his hand to the near side of the vanity where Olim kept a sharp knife she used to scrape the dark hairs from her chin. Yezelnik stepped forward, waving the knife out before him.
You will not make a fool of me again.
I fear you reached that marker long before I arrived. Truly, Prince Yezelnik, you are making this more difficult.
The highwayman's left hand shot out and slapped Yezelnik across the face, backhanded him the other way and slapped him a third time for good measure.
Why do you insist on making this harder?
In sheer frustration, he threw the knife. His eyes went wide indeed when he noted that the thief had caught it so easily.
Take my wife!
The highwayman sprang into a sidelong cartwheel, catching his hand on the edge of the vanity, planting his other hand flat on its top, and springing away to intercept Yezelnik at the door.
Your knife.
The highwayman tossed the blade into the air. To his credit, Yezelnik caught the blade, but when he looked back down, he found the tip of a fabulous and too familiar sword an inch from his face.
Now what am I to do with you?
Lady Olim threw her arm against her forehead and fell back, conveniently, onto the room's rather large bed.
Under the bed.
The highwayman prodded the prince with his sword, guiding him around. Finally, he stepped up and pushed Yezelnik forward.
Why, you ravish my wife above me?
The highwayman shoved Yezelnik harder for that, putting him down to his knees at the side of the bed.
You, with him, under the bed.
But...
Under the bed, now, the both of you.
Yezelnik grabbed Olim and dragged her under the bed with him.
In the middle.
Branson dropped down and prodded at them with his sword, forcing them back from the edge. He looked all around, thinking to block the four openings of the bed. But alas, there was not enough furniture in the room to seal them in. Improvising, he leapt in a roll across the end of the bed, coming to his feet facing the foot. He looked from its thin legs to his sword and back. His eyes scanned the headboard. He could clear it, and easily, he realized, as the movement sorted out before him. He had to be precise, he had to be quick, but he was jester too. The highwayman held his sword before him. Both hands grasped the hilt of the sword as he lifted it slowly before his right shoulder, keeping the blade perpendicular to the floor. He stepped out with his left foot suddenly, slashing the blade down low, then reversed the swing so quickly that it passed over the severed bed leg before the bed had even dropped. The foot of the bed dropped as the highwayman leaped back to the right in a twisting somersault. He came to his feet beside the bed, his back to it. Halfway up its length, he continued his spin, his blade neatly severing the third leg. The highwayman let go of the sword with his right hand as he came around. As soon as he faced the bed squarely again, his legs twitched, lifting him in a dive ahead and to the side. He dropped and slashed to the right, and the fourth and final leg fell away, dropping the full weight of the bed onto Yezelnik and Olim. The highwayman stepped back and regarded his handiwork with a nod that reflected both surprise and satisfaction. He looked down at the small sack tied to his belt, bulging with coin and jewels, and nodded again.
Do remember that I did not kill you, and it would have been an easy thing. And do remember that I did not ravish your wife.
Oh, you'll pay for this, you babbling ingrate! I will hunt you down like the dog you are!
You remember that I did not ravish her. I do hope that dear Lady Olim will forget that fact, for I am certain that my lack of action angers her more than anything else I might have done, murdering you included.
How dare you!
It is really quite easy.
The highwayman rushed away to the window, but darkness hadn't fallen yet, and the upper bailey teemed with guards. Nearly an hour passed before Prince Yezelnik finally managed to squirm out from under the heavy bed. Servants came rushing into the room. Olin squirmed out behind him.
You! You fancy yourself the Laird of a Holding and you cannot deal with a single thief? You are a hero among men, and yet a single small man chases you under your wife's bed like a frightened rabbit!
She moved to slap him, but Yezelnik caught her arm, then her other one, and held her fast.
Would you be less angry if he had ravished you?
It seemed as if Yezelnik only then realized that the room was full of people, many of whom were staring at his revealed wife.
Out! Out!
He gave a last disgusted look at Olim and followed. Olim brought her hands to her face. She was near sleep when soft lips brushed her forehead.
Marvelous lady.
The highwayman had never really left the room.
I cannot ravish a married woman by the code of honor that guides me, but I assure you that the code is sorely tried when I glimpse a creature of such beauty. Think of me as I travel the wilds of the Northland.
And then he was gone, sprinting to the window and going through so easily and swiftly that he was out before Olim had even glanced his way.
Not to fear.
Branson spoke to Callan and Kaedale the next day as they walked down the road out of Delaval, leading Dooley the donkey.
For I told Lady Olim that I would be in the north.
But our road is to the north, and there you will truly be.
Exactly.
Sure enough, Laird Delaval's guards, at the request of Prince Yezelnik, streamed out of the city that same morning, heading south in search of the highwaymen, as the Lady Olim had directed. The Samhaste priest Dantana crouched low as he moved through the area of knee-deep white caribou moss. The plant could be mashed into a potent salve and made a fine tea, but Dantana was looking for something even more valuable, daba bulbs. They only grew among the moss and never in great number. Even one bulb would make for a fine day's hunting, though, for the Samhaste could then prepare the most wonderful daba stew, a brew that would take all the pains from his joints for a week and more. Dantana didn't like this land, Alpinador, far preferring the milder climate of Vanguard south of the mountains. It was not his place to question, though, at least not openly. He had to keep telling himself that, for there was so much afoot in the world that Dantana, still young and not completely jaded, did indeed wish to question. He bent low and brushed aside the moss as he quickened his pace. He knew there would be some daba around this particularly thick strand of caribou moss. There had to be.
That's a bootlace, not a vine, boy.
Only then did Dantana realize that he was not alone in the white field. He looked up to see the weathered face, the thick mustache, and the pointed feathered cap. The man, standing tall and straight before him, might have been 40 or 70. He had those ageless features that exude both strength and the wisdom of experience. So much experience.
Master Sequin.
The old scout didn't answer other than to stare unblinkingly and witheringly at the Samhaste.
I did not know that you were in the area.
Like to state the obvious, do you?
I am Samhaste Dantana. Once we met, in Vanguard, and near to where the Abelic...
Chapel Pelennor.
Dantana nodded, trying not to look too pleased that this great man had remembered him.
I'll never forget a face, or the name of a man I consider worth remembering. What did you say your name was again?
Dantana.
You travel with old Baden.
Ancient Baden.
You're a long way from home, boy.
There is the war.
The one your ancient Baden started.
Not so. Dame Guaidra began it all. She chose and chose ill.
Because she fell in love with a man?
Because she fell in love with an Abelican monk.
An offense worth all of this. Well, you fight your battles as you choose them. Oh, let the folk of Vanguard choose which religion, Samhaste or Abelican, suits their needs.
And which for Jameson?
The old scout brought his arm out in front of him, holding a sack, and still applying that withering gaze over Dantana, he upended it before the man. More than a dozen pointy troll ears tumbled out onto the ground at Dantana's feet.
It's theirs to choose.
As is it yours.
Dantana stared at the multitude of ears, ears of creatures ancient Baden had enlisted in the fight.
If my choice is between a man and a troll, it's not a hard one, boy. I said I didn't much care, and I don't. But tell your ancient Baden that I'm not for letting glacial trolls murder families in the name of Samhain or in the name of anyone else.
Our struggle is...
None of my business and none of my care. When I see a troll, I kill a troll, and I don't ask who it's working for.
Master Sequin, if we meet again, will you remember my name?
I forgot it already.
From a high perch on the very edge of the great glacier cauldron, ancient Baden stared out across the miles of the Southland. In his mind's eye, he looked past the frozen tundra of Alpinador to the thick forests of Vanguard. He envisioned the battles raging there, haunts man against goblin, haunts man against glacial troll, haunts man against the sturdy Alpinadorian barbarians. His army, battling the men of Haunts, punishing them for their growing acceptance of the heretics of Blessed Abel. A smile creased ancient Baden's face, strangely white teeth standing brightly in the midst of his wild black mustache and beard. A gigantic affair that poked out in a semicircle of sharp points beneath the old Sam Haste's weathered face. Its ends sharpened by dung and plated with ribbons black and red.
They will learn.
Word had come that Chapel Pelennor had fallen, sacked as much by angry huntsmen as by ancient Baden's hordes. The few surviving monks were even then being dragged north to this place to be sacrificed to ancient Dno, the worm god of the frozen lands. Ancient Baden lowered his gaze to the clouds of steam at the base of the glacier's cliff face, where the ice met the hot waters of the lake called Mithranadun. The mist seemed to him to thicken, an indication, perhaps, that Dno was pleased by the news? Or his imagination, his thrill at the prospect of feeding the god so well? Ancient Baden envisioned the hot waters beneath that cloud, the holy lake of Mithranadun, the rift of Samhain, the gift of the Ancient Ones to their children as a reward for their wondrous efforts here. At a crevice some 50 feet north of where he stood, a pair of giants, 15 feet tall and with shoulders as wide as the wingspan of a great eagle, rolled heavy mallets up into the air, slamming them down concurrently upon the flattened head of a battered log. A sharpened wedge that drove deeper into the glacier with every smash. Once they had driven that one down to the level of the glacier, ancient Baden would bless the spike and prepare its end with spells and fire, that another could be placed upon it and driven down, pushing the bottom one even deeper. Over to the right of the giants, where the crevice was much wider and much deeper, several glacial trolls hung by their ankles, suspended beneath crossbeams by thin ropes. Their arms were weighted, forcing them into a diver's stretch, and their wrists had been expertly cut, their thin blood dripping down into the chasm and turning into a fine coating mist in the windy gorge. Troll blood did not freeze, and the coating of it in the crevice would prevent the melted waters from mitigating the damage to the edge of the glacier. One troll, at least one, was dead and dried out now, ancient Baden noted, but no worries, for the wretched little beasts were as thick as hares in summer Vanguard. He scanned farther to the right to the elaborate ice bridge he had magically constructed. It spanned the widest expanse of the chasm, with enough room on either side so that it would continue to allow crossing even when the rift had become as wide as intended. Ancient Baden couldn't help but smile as his gaze moved farther to the right, to the mountain wall bordering the glacier on the east, for against that dark stone loomed ancient Baden's greatest work yet, his home. Devongel, a castle of crystalline ice, of elegant winding spires and thick walls, of defensive and confusing mazes both practical and beautiful. His smile disappeared when he looked back to the left, over by the working giants, and noted a smaller form, dressed in the telltale light green robes of a Samhaste, though surely nothing as elaborate as ancient Baden's gown. decorated as it was with claws and teeth from various carnivores and with leafy designs woven with threads green and yellow so that it looked as if the Samhist could walk into a strand of brush and simply disappear. About his waist, Ancient Baden wore a thick red sash tied on his right hip with its frayed ends nearly reaching the ground. Only one Samhist, the Ancient himself, could wear this holiest of belts. And Ancient Baden put his hand on that knot now as the ever-annoying priest Dantana approached to remind himself of that honor. Wearing a sour expression, Dantana circled wide of the giants and hopped the crevice, which, 10 feet out from the spike, was no more than a crack, and neared Ancient Baden with a determined stride.
You have heard of Chapel Pelennor?
Burned, with its stones scattered.
Another victory over the Abelican heretics. Does that not please you?
Many men and women who are not Abelicans were killed in the fighting. Killed by goblins and trolls and the barbarian mercenaries.
That is the way of things.
Because we choose it to be. Once, we battled beside the Huntsmen of Vanguard against the very army we now turn loose upon them.
Once, and not long ago, they knew their place.
Dantana winced and quieted, the implications hanging heavily in the air. War was general south of the Gulf of Corona, laird against laird, with Ethelbert of Entel battling for dominance against the great Delaval. In that struggle, the true emerging winner seemed to be neither of the lairds, but rather the Abelican Church. For the monks with their magical gemstones, powerful in both healing and destruction, had gained favor with every laird. Though possessed of magic of their own, the Samhastes could not match that Abelican availability of useful tricks.
They look to the south. The men of Vanguard see the turning tide amongst the Hunt's brethren.
A tide turning away from us and from the Ancient Ones. It is a temporary thing, you understand.
Dantana didn't reply, except that his face showed little in the way of concession.
The Abelican monks dazzle with their baubles and provide comfort and even battle advantage. But they have little understanding of the proper preparations for the greater course. Death is inevitable, to lairds and to peasants. What answers might the foolish boys who follow the distorted memory of that idiot Abel offer to mortally wounded warriors?
Fewer are mortally wounded because of their work.
Temporary relief. Everyone dies.
Then perhaps we have a role to play in complement with the monks.
You would like that, would you not?
Dantana tilted his head a bit, as if he did not understand.
If we were to find a place beside the Abelicans?
Dantana began to shake his head and his eyes darted about as if he was looking for a way to flee.
How long did you think you could hide your allegiance to Dame Guaidra?
I know not of what you speak.
Do not play me for a fool. You counseled Guaidra extensively before her association with the Abelicans.
Ancient, the Abelicans have been in Vanguard Town for years, but before I ever came to know Lady Guaidra. Indeed, they were beside Laird Gendron before his death, when Guaidra was but a girl.
With all their magical bubbles, they still did not prevent his untimely death, did they?
Dantana winced, for it was widely rumored that the Samhastes had played a role in the accident that had taken the beloved Laird Gendron from the folk of Vanguard.
And so Guaidra rose to power in Vanguard Town, a young, impressionable girl.
Never that.
And when your master died, Guaidra's ear was passed to you. Your duty was clear, to keep Guaidra from the Abelican encroachment. Your own assessment, if you will, Dantana. Did you succeed or fail?
It was more complicated.
Are you couching an admission of failure?
No, Ancient. Dame Guaidra has sought a balance from the beginning. She counts me among her trusted advisors as she...
The monks of Chapel Pelennor?
Yes, but...
One of them in particular.
Dantana was unable to deny the truth of it. Dame Guaidra had fallen in love with an Abelican monk, and the Church of Abel had done nothing to dissuade the union, obviously for cynical political reasons. Chapel Pelennor stood on the outskirts of Vanguard Town, by far the most important town north of the Gulf of Corona. Dame Guaidra commanded the army of the entire Hanse province north of the Gulf of Corona, the region known as Vanguard. As her relationship with her lover Monk had grown, so had grown the power of the Abelicans in Vanguard town and across the land. Dantana had not been able to resist that movement and had come to believe that playing an amenable role was the only way he and the Samhastes could retain any semblance of influence over the feisty and headstrong dame of Vanguard. He had improvised. He had taken his own initiative. He had gambled and had thought that he was carving out a suitable role for his church. Until the hordes had descended upon Vanguard from the north at the direction of ancient Botan.
You wear your answer on your face, foolish Dantana. It is true, then.
Dame Guaidra beds a monk. Yes.
And you allowed it to happen.
Allowed?
Yes, allowed. You saw the relationship budding years ago, and you did not stop it.
Love takes its own course, ancient. I tried to dissuade Guaidra, indeed I did, but her heart was set and immovable.
And you did not kill this monk. Is the importance of this lost upon you?
No, ancient, no.
Then why did you not recognize your duty and fulfill it long ago? It has been many months since the commencement of the unholy tryst, and yet this Abelican still draws breath.
You ask me to murder a man?
Were you not so trained in the magic of poison? Do you think that training no more than an exercise in the hypothetical?
But I...
Have you not the power to kill a single young monk?
I am no murderer.
Murderer, bah! An ugly word for a noble task. How many lives would Dantana have saved if he had mustered his courage and done as his duty demanded? This entire war could have been avoided, or surely minimized, if Dame Guaidra had not been smitten by a heretic Abelican, you fool!
The war was one of choice!
Choice! You would cede the souls of thousands of Vanguardsmen to the heretic Abelicans?
We have our place!
Shut up! You have failed. In the one task which meant anything, the one action that might have avoided years of strife and carnage. The misery, the death, the rivers of blood are all upon you. Because you had not the courage to strike a single blow.
You cannot believe that.
I suppose, though, that I should thank you. The Ancient One saw fit to fill my divining pool with images of the Battle of Chapel Pelennor, and the screams and cries. It was glorious indeed.
How can you say that?
To hear men weeping like children, to hear the cries of women who knew they were doomed for their heresy, who knew their children would be torn apart in retribution? Oh, the beauty of justice. And do you know the greatest victory of all? The captives. Lines of them, hundreds of them perhaps, tethered together and marching for this very place. They will feed Dino, and his frenzy and heat will facilitate the severing.
Baden used the sanctifying term he had coined for his work on the edge of the glacier.
As Dino burrows and further melts the ice, we will feed him more. We will make him stronger and swifter, that he will reach to the stones about the ice to join our efforts with the earth magic of the Ancient Ones. I will allow you to offer many of them.
Offer them? You would murder them as food to further your ambitions here?
Murder. A word you use so easily. Their lives are forfeit by their own actions. They sided with heretics, and so you will exact proper punishment. Perhaps if I teach you to better wield that knife you were awarded, you will be less likely to fail us in the future when you are called upon by Alden his holy to put it to proper use.
As he spoke, Ancient Baden heard the man approach. Thus he was not surprised when the man standing right behind him shoved him hard. Nor did Ancient Baden resist that push, lifting his arms gloriously wide as he went off the edge of the glacier, plummeting toward the mist below. Ancient Baden heard the scream and smiled all the wider, knowing that he had pushed the young fool to abject desperation. He closed his eyes and felt the wind thrumming about his falling form. He used that sensation of freedom from the mortal boundaries to fall deeper into his magic. Back up on the ledge, Dantana did not immediately see the transformation as ancient Baden assumed the most ancient form of all. His arms became leathery wings, his eyes turned yellow with a single line of black in the middle, and his face elongated into a snout filled with fangs and spear-like horns sprouted atop his head. Dantana scanned far below to see a dragon swooping out from the mist, rising suddenly on the updrafts from the hot waters of the mystical Mithranidoon. Dantana scrambled to his feet and turned about, stumbling as he tried to flee. Dantana felt a thunderous slam against his back. He didn't fly forward, though. He surely would have, had not a large talon-tipped foot closed about him to hold him fast. Flailing, he went up into the air a dozen feet and more. Then he was falling, landing hard against the ice. Again he was scooped in dragon claws. Again ancient Baden lifted him into the air, and again ancient Baden dropped him, though higher up this time. Dantana hit, his legs snapping under his weight, ligaments tearing, bones breaking. But the dragon grabbed him again, carrying him even higher. Somewhere, in the back of his rapidly fleeing thoughts, Dantana expected to be hoisted again, but it didn't happen, and he settled down into the deep, cold, gloomy recesses of darkness. Sharp, agonizing stabs of pain in his shattered limbs awakened him sometime later. He was hanging by his ankles from the very rope he had noted on the new platform suspended over the chasm. His hands were securely and tightly bound behind him.
You failed.
Dantana managed to turn his head. He saw that ancient Baden was standing on the edge of the platform only a couple of feet to the side and above. At the man's feet lay a sack, its contents of troll ears spilled.
A pity. I had thought to educate you. I had thought to build your resolve and your understanding.
As he spoke, the ancient lifted his arm and signaled behind him. Ancient Baden watched passively as Dantana was slowly lowered into the gorge. In the dimming light, Dantana could see the myriad tunnels along the sides of the chasm. The ice was wet down here, as the pieces melted by Dunur blended as they were with the mist of glacial trolls' blood, could not fully refreeze. The web of tunnels, the burrowing of Dunur. Dantana touched down on the wet ice, a trickle of water running past him. Now he scrambled more furiously, tugging his hands from side to side. Somehow, he managed to pull one free, and the other slipped out of the noose. He rolled over and sat up, grimacing against the waves of pain emanating from his legs. He worked desperately at the ties about his ankle. His hands were numb and cold, though, and he couldn't get a proper grip on the rope. He could feel the intense heat of Dunur. He turned to face his doom just as the giant worm lashed at him. From the platform above the crevice, ancient Baden could see nothing of the feast. The rope tugged and jerked a couple of times. Ancient Baden motioned behind him, and the trolls operating the crank began turning it furiously. The rope came up, and Baden saw the bottom half of Dantana's leg still attached, the skin of the upper calf blackened by the heat of Dunur.
Eat well, ancient one.